Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Welcome to another episode of EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Thomas Berger, and I'm sitting here together with my guest, with my conversation partner in Helsinki, EAN Conference, Congress. And my guest today, warm welcome, is Professor Tobias Kronberg. He's Professor of Neurology and Chair of the Department of Neurology at the Skåne University Hospital in Lund and Malmö in Sweden. Warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
And we're talking today about neurointensive care, highly important topic also for our younger colleagues. Not everywhere neurointensive care is educated because they are lacking the respective units. And also sometimes there are controversies on different procedures. So what I learned is that you gave a talk at the joint EAN and European Cardiology Society session about hypothermia in cardiac arrest.
Yeah, that's true. The neurologist perspective on hypothermia.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. So what is your perspective on the hypothermia in cardiac arrest?
Well, to conclude, if I would say it, you could say that hypothermia has had a long journey. It has been introduced as a very powerful treatment for cardiac arrest-induced brain injury. But unfortunately, it hasn't fulfilled the promise that it made. So today, hypothermia is no longer a treatment option for patients after cardiac arrest, I would say.
And what have been the drawbacks, or what was it, a conceptual issue or a mechanistic issue?
I think it's much to the mechanisms. Mm-hmm. I think it has been translated from a lot of experimental animal research. And there were high expectations. And then there were two clinical trials published in 2002, mm-hmm. The European Hawker trial, which was a reasonably sized study with 273 patients, and the much smaller Australian Bernard trial. But mm-hmm. they were published at the same time in the New England Journal of Medicine, and both showed a favorable effect on survival and neurological function. And that just started an enormous introduction of hypothermia as a treatment. But after that, the effect has been questioned, and mainly from our group. And we have done a series of trials trying to see if we could verify the effect of hypothermia, and there has been no effect at all.
Yeah. And if you're talking about effect, you mean outcome?
Yeah, I mean outcome. And while the initial trials had outcome of mortality and neurological function, we have also had that, mm-hmm. because mortality is a fantastic outcome in cardiac arrest since half of the patients die. Mm-hmm. So if it's a very powerful outcome. But we have also gone into detail on cognitive function and even done a neuropsychological sub-study. We have done biomarkers of brain injury, mm-hmm. lots of comparisons, and the groups are so incredibly similar, if you could or not.
And this regards not only clinical research studies you have done, but also experimental?
No, this is the clinical study.
Okay.
Yeah. But we did also a meta-analysis of the previous experimental studies. Mm-hmm. And that was after the first TTM trial. In the TTM trial, we compared two different temperatures, mm-hmm. 33 and 36. Mm-hmm. And everything else around the patients were identical. Mm-hmm. And it was a much bigger trial than the Hawke and Bernard trials. It was almost 1,000 patients, mm-hmm. 950. I think it was a very good design of the study in the sense that you only changed the temperature mm-hmm. settings of mm-hmm. the machine.
I see.
Everything else identical.
Okay.
And we had also very strict control of, mm-hmm. of the issue of neurological prognostication and withdrawal of life-sustaining mm-hmm. therapy, because that's an important potential mm-hmm. bias.
Are there, I'm not a neurointensive care specialist,
right.
I have to confess, but there are different ways, to my memory, different ways how to do hypothermia. Does this also relate to the outcome, or is it irrespective of the method how to induce hypothermia?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of discussion about the ways to induce. Mm-hmm. Should you use a cooling catheter with intra-arterial cooling, which is slightly more rapidly, or should you just use surface cooling?
I see.
So the typical way of doing it is to have a surface cooling device and in combination with cold fluids.
I see.
To get the patient down in temperature. But then you could use a catheter, and we have done sub-studies looking at the difference, because in our studies, centers could choose whether they use a catheter or surface device. But if you compare, you couldn't see any difference in outcome. You could see that the patients with arterial cooling becomes cooled a little bit faster.
Now, another innocent question from my side. Sweden is a country where wintertime is quite cold.
Yeah.
Does it make a difference if a patient with a cardiac arrest is coming already cooled because he was outside during activities, and so he's hypotherm at the time point of, does it make a difference then if the patient is admitted to an intensive care ward?
Yeah, I think so. We don't have studies showing that, so we don't have hard evidence, but we have a lot of clinical examples. The best way is to cool the patient, or the patient cooling themselves before the cardiac arrest.
Okay.
So cold water drowning, for example.
Okay.
Or I had the example with a lady in Norway who was skiing and fell and slided out to thin ice and was stuck under the ice and cooled down. Her friends couldn't save her because the ice was so thin, so they couldn't get her up. And when she got to the hospital, she was 13.7 degrees. 13.7 degrees.
Wow.
And she had been in cardiac arrest for more than 2 hours.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So she was really dead in many senses.
Yeah.
But they started rewarming her.
Okay.
And she got back her cardiac function, and gradually she awoke. And she had no obvious cognitive problems. She had, of course, a rehabilitation period, but she could go back to work as a physician.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She had some motor problems, so she turned to being a radiologist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fantastic case. Mm-hmm. I mean, in normothermia, you couldn't have a cardiac arrest for more than 5 minutes. If nobody does anything, if you don't have any resuscitation, maybe up to ideal session settings up to 10 minutes. But then it's just lost. With enormous brain injury.
You know, given this example, which is, of course, a rare but an extremely interesting case, does individual predisposition make a difference in the procedure of hypothermia?
Not really. You mean body weight, for instance?
Yes, or risk factors or concomitant disorders or sex differences.
Hypothermia could make it more easy to bleed, so you have to consider that if you have anticoagulation, for example. There is no real sex difference in whether hypothermia would work better in men or women. And we have looked at we have done meta-analysis of both our trials, the TTM-1 and TTM-2, to try to see if there is a group of patients who would benefit from hypothermia. And then we have used risk scores.
Okay.
So you could use risk scores, which include how long the cardiac arrest was, what kind of heart rhythm you had when you came to the hospital, and how your neurology was on entrance to the hospital, etc. You get a risk score, and if we divide it into three groups with a high, medium, and low risk of brain injury, we couldn't see any effect of hypothermia there, because that has been much discussed, whether we could select patients for hypothermia.
Our podcast is listened by a lot of young neurologists. So what would be your clinical advice, your clinical approach with regard to hypothermia?
Well, if we have a patient coming to the hospital who is hypothermic and had a cardiac arrest, you shouldn't start rewarming actively that patient. That's important. You should remember that patient actually has an ongoing treatment. Okay. So let the patient rewarm very slowly.
Okay.
Yeah. that's an important, of course, it depends on which temperature the patient
has. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if it's 13 degrees, you have to rewarm, obviously.
Obviously.
Yes. Yeah, but if the patient have, for example, 34 degrees, yeah, you could be very careful not to rewarm very fast. So that's an advice that's also in the new guidelines from the European Resuscitation Council.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you shouldn't start cooling patients. So there is really today no patient that you should cool after cardiac arrest.
So does it only regard patients with cardiac arrest or any patient at the neurointensive care?
Malignant hyperthermia, you mm-hmm. could use, of course, temperature control. But otherwise, I couldn't really see indication. There has been, when hypothermia was introduced for cardiac arrest, it started a lot of research in stroke, mm-hmm. in brain mm-hmm. trauma, or status mm-hmm. epilepticus. Mm-hmm. And hypothermia is a powerful treatment against edema, generalized edema. I was talking to an Austrian colleague the other day, and he said that they use it for edema treatment. Whether that would be something that you could use systematically, I wouldn't say. I don't think that it's used at many intensive care units.
I see,
But it's not for trauma. It has not been effective. It has not been effective in other conditions.
I see.
So hypothermia is really on the way out, but there may still be an option if mm-hmm. we could cool faster. And there are ongoing studies on that. So we have the Princess 2 trial where mm-hmm. they cool the patient in a pre-hospital setting during resuscitation with nasal cooling, a special device for that.
Mm-hmm.
It must be an extremely complicated trial to pursue.
Yeah, it seems so, yeah.
Yeah, with all these pre-hospital units.
Yeah.
But they saw an effect in the Princess 1 trial in a subgroup analysis on ventricular fibrillation patients. Okay. So perhaps that could be something.
But we can conclude, or I conclude from what you're telling me, that there's no overt advantage.
No, unfortunately not, because we don't have anything else.
Yeah.
And that's from a scientist's perspective, it's really sad.
Yeah, it's not really encouraging if you have to recognize nothing else.
Mm.
And the thing you were relying on for 20 years or nearly is not that effective as expected.
No, and it has proved a lot more difficult to remove this treatment option than to introduce it. It was fast to introduce, but it has been very, very slow to back down from hypothermia.
Yeah, but I think this is a typical situation in medicine. You know, if something is new and more or less broadly accepted, it's carved in stone. And to get this out again is, with all the good arguments, is tremendously difficult. Right?
Yeah, I think that's a general thing.
So, Tobias, thank you very much. I think it was highly interesting. It is, let's say, an important recognition and also mind changer, because if something has been established for nearly 25 years and then it turns out that it's not that effective as expected or wished, I think it's very brave to also show this. So thank you very much. We're looking very forward to, I guess you will be engaged in the ongoing studies or in future studies. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. And
thank you.
Hopefully our auditorium also enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. ENCAST Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.